Chapter 26 Continued. A long shower helped Hollis in a lot of ways. By the time he had dried and shaved and dressed, he had regained his composure and his equanimity. So Susan did not understand vibrational meditation. Big deal. Most people didn't. And if one did not understand the meditative process, one had no context, no frame of reference for understanding one's naked husband behind the couch in full lotus. He knew that an erection was a natural result of increased circulation that came from a successful meditation. But how was she to know that? She wouldn't know, and really, it was unreasonable to expect her to know. So he needed to let all of that go. There, he thought, as he cinched his belt. Done. Released. No longer an issue. And the same with her reaction in bed. How was she supposed to react to his sudden, unannounced affection, particularly if she had been harboring the belief that he had been adulterously engaged the previous night? Again, she had only reacted consistent with her level of understanding. There. Done. Released. He went downstairs into the kitchen, following the smell of eggs and bacon and coffee, and the sound of CNN barking out its half-hourly roundup of news.
Minutes after the hour, with these headlines, at least 43 people died and 76 were injured in 3 car bombings in the center of the Iraqi capital.
There you are. Would you like some breakfast?
Susan had a tight, artificial solicitude in her voice. She, too, had obviously decided to let it go, whatever she had concluded it had been.
I'd love some, my dear, he responded with a muscular cheeriness.
He set the table and poured them each a cup of coffee.
How's Ben?
Still sacked out. He was up late last night. After his little dance with May, he was too wound up to go to sleep. He came out and loved on Rhonda a while before she left, and that was after 11. He's always connected with Rhonda. Haven't you noticed that? I think it's because she's so lonely. I think he picks up on that. Rhonda loves it.
Unlike May, said Hollis.
Susan gave a small laugh and shook her head as she turned off the burners and pushed the eggs around the pan.
Unlike May.
More than she bargained for. Poor David.
Oh, David's fine. Don't worry about David.
Anyway, then Rhonda left, and by the time Gail and I finished with the dishes and she left, it had to be after 1 or 1:30, and Ben was still up, watching television.
Susan divided up the strips of bacon and eggs onto plates and set them down on the kitchen table where Hollis waited. She went back to collect 4 pieces of toast from the toaster and then some butter and blackberry jam from the refrigerator.
Thanks for the coffee, she said as she sat down.
United States civil liberties groups have launched a lawsuit to force the release of 87 pictures and 4 videos showing abuse at Abu Ghraib jail in Baghdad.
Can we turn that off?
I'm listening to the news.
It's yelling.
It's not yelling, Hollis. It's the news. It's CNN.
I'm not a TV watcher.
Yes, I know you're not. I am. I like to know what's going on in the world.
There's always the newspaper. That's got some news.
Argues the photos should stay confidential and out of public view to avoid...
Susan turned her head to see the small screen on the counter behind her, then returned to buttering her toast.
You know what I was thinking this morning?
He asked, cutting into the bacon. Susan waited a beat too long before answering.
I really have no idea what you were thinking this morning, Hollis.
I was thinking about the time when you were still in school and we took that road trip to see Buffalo Springfield.
In Iraq could exceed $700 billion. In current dollars, Vietnam cost U.S. taxpayers $600 billion.
Remember, my Valiant was in the shop, so we borrowed, what was his name?
Kay. Bobby Kay. Bobby?
Tommy, said Susan.
Tommy Kay, that's right. We borrowed Tommy Kay's beat-up beast of a van and nursed that thing all the way to Chicago and back. Must have broken down 6 times.
Working on his 2nd strip of bacon, Hollis laughed and shook his head, as if to himself, as if lost in unbidden reverie. And every time that thing broke down, you decided that the engine just needed a rest and that the best thing we could do was take the opportunity to make love in the back. Remember that?
Would nearly double the projected federal budget deficit over the next decade. Since 2001, the U.S. has deployed more than 1 million troops to those two countries.
And of course you were so full of it back then. I just took instruction and did as I was told. Left the key in the ignition and headed on into the back, and there you were, ready to go. He laughed a little louder and shook his head again. I was so sore after that weekend, contorting myself around that makeshift bed, like I'd been in a rodeo. We must have done it a dozen times in 3 days. Susan looked at him inscrutably over her coffee. She took a sip and then set the mug down on the table.
What do you mean, full of it?
What?
You said that back then I was full of it. What do you mean? Full of what?
Oh, he said. Life, I guess. Self-possessed. Confident. Mischievous. Unconcerned with what others thought of you. You know, young and full of it. Master of your own destiny.
And now I'm old and not so full of life anymore. Is that it?
Hollis looked up at his wife of 37 years and chewed at her contemplatively for a moment, then took a sip of his own coffee. I wasn't insulting you, Susan. Everyone changes.
Sure doesn't sound like a very good or appealing change to me, Hollis.
The familiar fog started to roll in over the table, coming for him. It wanted to gather him up in billowy arms, secreting him from view, dampening all sound but his own inner voice. It came from nowhere, over her shoulders and over the top of her head, spilling down over her face onto the table, obscuring her half-eaten eggs, then pillowing up between them so that she seemed farther and farther away. And as it rolled and plumed, the fog sang its song. Susan would never understand the subtler truths, those truths beyond the veil of emotion, beyond the ego. Not because she was incapable, but because she was unwilling. She chose to be too defensive to see things clearly. She chose to be too wrapped up in how the truth would make her look in the end. She chose to be instantly taken in and utterly convinced by the most superficial of impressions. For Susan, the truth comes from the 30-something man reading a teleprompter on TV. Truth comes from the movies and glossy magazines. Age is all about wrinkles. Meditation in the nude must be about jerking off. Staying out late with a young woman must be about sex. Deeper consciousness could not be seen and, therefore, did not exist. All he could do was lay his truth, the truth, at her feet and back away. She would have to choose to pick it up or leave it. But she would not be taught. She would not be convinced. Not by him. It was time, said the fog, and he agreed, to go to the study and trim the bonsai.
Got political capital. I'm going to spend it.
Hollis?
Hmm?
I said it doesn't sound like a very appealing change.
Mm-hmm. Everyone changes.
Okay, fine. Everyone changes. Well, why don't you tell me the ways you think I've changed?
Hollis?
How have I changed? Susan? No, really, I'd like to know how you think I've changed.
You're fine.
You think I'm the only one getting old? You think you're immune?
You're fine, Susan. Chronologically, we all get older. Me too.
Oh, I get it. We're back to the you're only as old as you think you are nonsense.
Hollis finished his eggs and stood up from the table. The fog lifted him from his chair by the elbows. He carried his plate to the sink and ran it under the water. Susan swiveled to watch him.
Hollis?
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to tell me what you meant?
I didn't mean anything. You're fine.
You're telling me that I've started thinking old, that I've let myself go before my time? Is that it?
Don't know. Guess you'll just have to try and figure that out. It was the wrong thing to say. Even the fog around him convulsed a little at the comment, which was not conducive to mere evasion and extrication. Hollis had reached through the fog and given her a good poke in the eye. It was a provocative statement, an aggressive act. "You'll just have to try and figure that out," he had said, suggesting that perhaps the real problem here was a lack of intellectual horsepower, that he was the patient master who knew the answer and she the student still groping in the dark for a clue. That's how she would take it, anyway. Perhaps he did feel a bit embarrassed about the morning's meditation, after all. Perhaps he did feel sexually rejected. Perhaps he did feel like he had made sacrifices in the name of marital fidelity that were not only unappreciated by his wife, but entirely disbelieved. Whatever the reason, Hollis did not bother to second-guess his own motives. It was done. The fog dissipated from around him, spiraling down the sink with the running water.
"Oh, really? You're going to leave it to me, stupid little me, to figure it out?"
"Oh, Susan, look, I wasn't saying..."
"Well, how about this? You're only as old as your circumstances allow." "You want to know what that means, Hollis?"
"Susan..."
"It means that while you have been out doing your little thing all these years, I have been raising 3 children and folding underwear and making sure we all have something to eat and something to wear and someplace neat and clean to live in. Meanwhile, you're out doing whatever it is you do in order to feel young and full of it."
"Wait just a minute there. You think I had nothing to do with food, clothing, and a very nice place to live? College educations? You think that just fell out of the sky?"
"That's not what I'm talking about, Hollis. I quit a teaching career. I left some very good opportunities on the table so that I could raise our family. Our family.
2 $40,000 remodels to this place."
"Yes, you've spent a lot of money. But
a place for David to live at his age."
"At his age? What? Tired of bankrolling David? I took a crash course in raising a Down syndrome child, and all these years later, the course still isn't over. Don't complain to me about open-ended parenthood."
"Nice cars, nice appliances."
"You pay for it all, but then you're absent. For your family, for me, you're a swell banker who keeps banker's hours, Hollis."
"A healthy retirement fund."
"Retirement. Yeah. How is retirement coming, Hollis? I thought you were going to travel. I thought we would at least have lots more time together. I saw more of you when you were working. Mostly what you've done since you retired is hunker down in your study with case after case of wine and your little pruning shears and your music and your philosophy and all your opinions about the great unwashed. All of which is perfectly fine, except that you share none of it with me. Well, except the opinions. I get plenty of those, thank you very much. And you are absent."
President George W. Bush on Wednesday would give no timetable for an eventual pullout, saying only, "As Iraqis stand up, we will stand down."
"I'm not absent."
"You are absent, Hollis. You couldn't even show up on time for your own daughter's party, and then you left before it was half over."
"It was a ridiculous party. My daughter wasn't even present."
"That's right. She wasn't. Ever wonder, Hollis, why we never see Tilly?"
"No, I'm not taking the rap for Tilly's bullshit, Susan. She can come home or not come home. It's her decision. She's caught up in the whole Hollywood cesspool. It has nothing to do with me. Nothing."
"It has everything to do with you, Hollis. You don't approve of her. You judge her mercilessly. Cesspool? Why should she want to come home to hear that? And then there's us. She told you she wouldn't come home until we got counseling. Have you ever known Tilly to back down?"
"I won't be bullied into one single conversation with Dr. Feelgood dipshit, who wouldn't know the first thing about..."
"It doesn't have to be, Dr. Lenz. Pick someone up to your standards."
"Tilly's the one who could use counseling. She threw away a perfectly good education and a first-rate mind so that she could screw half of Southern California."
"There you have it. And I'm amazed she doesn't come home to hear that."
"I won't be bullied into counseling."
"Right. So there's no counseling because you won't go. You refuse to go. It doesn't matter who the counselor is. That's just the excuse. Could be anyone, but no deal. As usual, you're absent and completely unaccounted for. You surface for breakfast and you surface for dinner because even Sufi mystics have to eat. But then you're gone. You're down to your cave.
or you're off to show sweet little Bethany Cohen a good time, or you're off hiding behind the sofa. This is all about last night, isn't it?
What are you talking about?
This is all about me taking Beth to Wally Nunn's retirement party.
Beth? Now it's Beth?
That's what this is about, isn't it? It's all clear now. Hollis, I have no issues whatsoever with Beth.
Wrong, Susan. You have worked yourself into a lather this morning because you think I was out screwing Beth last night. You look at what could be, what should be, a perfectly innocent relationship, and you make completely unfounded assumptions.
No, you're wrong. I don't care one bit what you and Beth were up to last night, and I'm perfectly prepared to believe that you simply took her to a retirement party. Frankly, I have an easier time believing that than I do believing that Beth, who can clearly have her pick of men, would choose to screw someone three times her age. But hey, I couldn't care less. My only concerns about last night...
Susan, don't interrupt.
My only concerns about last night are, first, that you never bothered to tell me that you were planning on leaving before dinner. That's just a matter of common courtesy. I mean, I've got dinner in the oven. May's sprawled out on the carpet with a concussion. Ben's all upset. And you're just out the door with a wink and a wave.
The problem was not that I left, Susan. It was that I left with Beth.
You're interrupting. Second, you were no help in any aspect of that party. I did absolutely everything, as usual.
The wine did not just buy itself.
And third, and far more important, it bothers me that you cared more about Wally Nunn's retirement party and whatever benefit it might have had for your little eye candy companion than a celebration for your own daughter.
I was being helpful to the daughter of a good friend.
You met the guy once, Hollis, Mr. Mitsubishi Akihito Takada. Whatever. You met him once, a long time ago, for a week. And I'll say it again, I don't think you were screwing Bethany Cohen. I don't think you're quite her speed. And furthermore, I think you get too much satisfaction out of insisting that you passed on a sexual opportunity for the sake of some bullshit claim to purity.
Violence in Iraq this month has killed 36 U.S. troops, including 20 Marines, based in Ohio towns.
Susan, wait, what are you saying? I'm saying that fidelity is a big moral power play for you. You like to swing it around like a club. For all I know, Beth, could have run off with some hot young banker at the party, and you'd be standing in this kitchen telling me that you turned her down, because you are, after all, infallible.
Well, that's just... You've topped yourself, Susan. That's just insane.
You're the one who likes to make snap judgments of infidelity, not me.
What?
I wasn't going to comment on your trip down memory lane, but you've got it all wrong. We borrowed Tommy Kay's van to go see my parents. We rode with Rick Patterson and Duncan Sims and Laura Compton to see Buffalo Springfield.
What?
Yes, we got separated at the concert and Smithy and I were the first ones back.
No.
Yes, Hollis. Smithy and I were the first ones back to the hotel, and when you and the others showed up, you were instantly convinced, Hollis, that we'd been screwing for hours. It ruined the whole trip. You sulked all the way back to Kent State. You wouldn't believe a thing I said on the matter. It took a long talk with Duncan to straighten you out. You were an ass. Of course, nothing ever happened.
Because you'd never do anything like that, would you, Susan?
I never said that. That's your line, Hollis. That holier-than-thou crap is all yours. It's like you've spent years making this perfect replica of yourself, a flawless two-dimensional doppelganger that knows everything, that does everything right for all the right reasons, and you send him out into the world as your public relations agent. And as sick as that is, the worst part is that you've come to believe your own self-serving illusion. You and most other people, except me and Tilly and David, believe that's the real you. You've got so much invested in this guy that he has completely taken over your life, Hollis, as you stay in the shadows, doing a lot of drinking and not much real living. He's perfect and you're absent.
Baloney.
Mistakes? Yeah, I make them all the time, Hollis. My misjudgments are hanging out there for the whole world to see, or at least for you to see and make sure I never forget them. But when was the last time you admitted to me or anyone else that you made a significant mistake in judgment? That you did not know something? That you had been wrong? that you were sad or lonely or angry, that you had vices that were difficult to control, that you feel betrayed by the bank for nudging you out early.
It's a business, Susan, with legitimate business concerns.
Spare me, Hollis. They showed you the door a year and a half early, and you deserved a whole lot more than that. After what you gave them? But you won't even acknowledge the injustice. You send out the doppelganger, Hollis, to take everything in stride, full of understanding and magnanimity. Where's the real Hollis? Absent, off having a nice glass of Pinot. If you had come home last night and told me that in a moment of lustful weakness you had screwed Beth to within an inch of her young life, at least I'd know you were alive and human. At least I would know that I was not talking to the doppelganger, that I was talking to the real you. But no, the real you is absent. Instead, I have someone in my kitchen suggesting that I'm crazy for thinking anything of the kind is even possible. Well, maybe it is and maybe it isn't possible, Hollis. Maybe you are all-knowing and pure as the driven snow. But I am sick of being crucified for not being you. And I'm sick of being clubbed by your self-righteousness.
Well, I can certainly see where Tilly got her penchant for drama.
Number of significant terrorist attacks reached a record 655 in 2004, up from 175 in 2003.
Fine, make a joke. That's fine. I'm all drama. Here's what I'm going to do. I really need to be away from you right now. I had decided I was not going to do this, but this morning really changed my mind. I'm leaving for a week to get my head together.
What? Where? You can't just...
I am, Hollis. I am. I'm going to a retreat with Gail up to Peebles.
Gail? You mean tattooed lesbian biker Gail?
It's a 7-day strategy workshop with Meredith Donner and her group to organize against the war in Iraq.
Oh, for Christ's sake, Susan, don't go getting sucked into all that.
President Bush acknowledged anti-war activists camped outside the ranch, saying he had thought about their cries to pull out of Iraq, but said that he, quote, strongly disagrees. Ms. Sheehan has stayed several days outside the ranch in a peaceful protest of the 2.5-year conflict. Mr. Bush said that while he sympathized with Sheehan...
Haven't you been paying attention, Hollis? Oh, I forgot, you don't watch the news. You're a reader. Well, it's a filthy, bloody mess out there, and our government, which has lied to us from the beginning, doesn't seem to care a whole lot. Somebody's got to do something. So why not me?
Susan, so what, you're suddenly an overnight pie-in-the-sky radical?
No, Hollis, I'm a long-time pie-in-the-sky radical. Who, having been informed by the doppelganger of her absentee husband that she is old-thinking and no longer full of it, is suddenly tired of repressing the urge to get involved.
Does this mean you're a lesbian too?
Don't know. Maybe. Guess that's something you'll just have to try to figure out.
What about Ben?
What about Ben? You're a co-equal parent, suddenly retired with a lot of time on your hands. If you're not absent, as you insist, then it should not be a problem, right?
Susan?
Well, there's my handsome prince. Good morning, sunshine. Up so early. The change in her tone was so immediate and authentic, it was jarring.
Hollis looked to the doorway of the kitchen to find his youngest son standing limp-armed and blinking slowly in his Buckeyes pajamas. He padded in on doughy white feet and wrapped his arms around Susan. She smothered him with kisses, and he yawned and giggled and bounced a little. Releasing her, he plodded in toward the sink, grabbing Hollis around the shoulders and squeezing.
"Morning, big guy," Hollis said, tousling his hair. "Did we wake you up?"
Ben shook his head. A broad smile spread across his face, and his small eyes closed to a squint, and he bounced a little on his toes. "Love her," he said, the flat white dish of his face threatening to crack from one end to the other from smiling. He hugged Hollis again, this time with enough force to squeeze out a grunt.
"Whoa, Benster, not so hard, fella.
I do love her. We were just talking, that's all." "No, I love her. I love her, I love her."
Ben bounced and clapped and did an impromptu dance in front of the stove.
"I love you too, sweetheart," said Susan. "Aren't you a lovebird this morning? Neck, neck, neck on the neck, neck, neck."
Hollis and Susan looked at each other, mutual anger temporarily preempted.
"Baby, what are you talking about?
May, May, May! Kissed her on the neck, neck, neck! Lover, lover, lover on the neck, neck, neck! May, 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 smooth and soft, smooth and soft.
Ben continued on about his older brother's freshly concussed girlfriend, pirouetting out of the kitchen with his arms around an imaginary person. Susan sputtered, doing her best to stifle a laugh. Hollis did not look at her. He was close to laughing himself, but he did not want to laugh. He did not want all this, all of what she had said to him, all that she had thrown up in his face, to be whisked away with a laugh. Doppelganger. He turned and scrubbed a dish that did not need scrubbing. Hollis, she said, softness in her tone, reconciliation in her tone. Really? You and Gail go have a fine time doing whatever it is you intend to do. Ben and I will be great. Better than great. We'll invite David over and have a bachelor's night for ourselves. Go sow your oats, stop the war, change the world. Whatever in the hell it is you want to do. Hollis.
Administration continues to link the war in Iraq to global terrorism dating back to September 11, 2001, saying insurgents were striving to turn the Middle East into a launching pad for attacks against free people. And, coming up in the next half hour, we'll take a look at the supermodel health crisis. Just how thin is too thin?
He marched out of the kitchen without looking at her. And when he heard her ask where he was going, he did not answer. She knew where he was going. He went downstairs to his study and closed the door. The silence sealed itself in tightly around him, and he stood for a moment, arms crossed, just being still. Eventually, he sank down heavily into his chair and stared blankly at the walls, lined with all his books, each its own course of study, each its own leather-bound diploma. Albert Einstein, Life and Times. Selected Works of the Great Thinkers, Volumes 1 and 2. Vibrational Meditation. Seven Gateways to Harmony. I Ching. The Tao of Modern Life. Increasing Awareness. Tao Te Ching. Unlocking the Mind. Zhuangzi. The Enlightened Path. The School of Madhyamaka. Contemplating the Inscrutable. The Quiet Man. Secrets of Zen Gardening. Knowing Buddha. The Art of War. The Connoisseur's Guide to Fine Wine. The Tao of the Guitar. Grillmaster. The Tao of Cow. On the shelf above the desk sat the stereo, in all its black, gleaming, miniaturized sleekness. At opposite ends of the same shelf, two small mahogany-encased speakers served as bookends, pressing the volumes up against the sides of the stereo. Hollis stared at the little green sliver of light on the volume knob. Wagner came instantly to mind, and for a moment he was filled with the impulse to play Ride of the Valkyries, very loud, very, very loud. But the impulse passed, not because Wagner did not suit him. Wagner certainly did suit him. Now more than ever before in recent memory. But then what? Would it really make him feel any better? When the last cymbals had crashed, when the last sonic explosions had drifted off through the walls, would he feel as though the demons had been exorcised, or even just pushed away temporarily? Will Wagner have taken up the fight on his behalf? Perhaps. But just as likely it would all come to nothing. Susan would not hear. Oh, she would hear all right, but she would not listen. She would ignore him. He was always ignored. No one cared what he did, what he said, what he thought. And in the end, when all was silent once again, he will have accomplished nothing but the emasculation of Richard Wagner. If Wagner could not lay waste and leave only ruin in his wake, then there was really no point. Below the stereo, the bonsai sat quietly on the desk in its glossy green planter. So perfect, so tidy, a study in symmetrical harmony. Its three major branches, although leafy and dotted with small white flowers, were each knotted and gnarled and scarred, showing its age in the way that crags and wrinkles in a human face would show the same 75 years of life.
The branches each twisted their way outward from the thick, crenellated trunk, sweeping slightly clockwise around the center of gravity, so that, looking directly down upon the tree, lent to a kind of slow, swirling effect. On some late evenings, Hollis had been able to see the arms of a spiral galaxy, their soft, leafy fuzziness a function of billions of points of ancient starlight wrapped loosely in ribbons of interstellar gas. And each flower 100 billion suns, too powerful for time and distance to obscure. All in slow orbit around an invisible center. The illusion was most effective when he placed the pot on the floor, turned off the overhead lights, using the desk lamp for a softer, indirect illumination, and stood on his chair to obtain the right perspective and distance. When the conditions were right, after a minute of staring directly down onto the center of the tree with its three spiraling branches, the universe unveiled itself to him. Hollis stood up and grabbed the old and tiny tree by the edge of its ceramic containment, pulling it toward him across the desk. He looked straight down over its center, closing one eye to at least partially compensate for what he knew to be a lack of perspective and distance. He did not see the soft arms of a living green spiral galaxy. He saw, instead, for the countless time that morning, water. He saw a whirlpool, not of interstellar gases and ancient light, but of water. Common, instantly replenishing, water. He saw a great flushing of water, a flawless whirlpool down the shithole of a toilet. Hollis could almost hear the sound in his head. Foosh. And when the tank refilled, it refilled with rage, messy, common, unproductive, unthinking, undignified rage. He felt himself filling with an amorphous, undisciplined anger that chose no one and spared no one, coating all creation like a sticky, toxic fog. Hollis sat down violently, snatching open the front drawer of the desk and extracting the shears. He unsnapped the blades from their leather special edition designer holster and, without the hesitation of a single thought, sliced through the lowest of the major branches. The severed limb glanced off the side of the pot, rolled along the desk for half its wooden, leafy flower-strewn coil, and fell to the floor. Hollis kicked the branch with his foot, first unintentionally, and then, with swift deliberation, back toward the heat register, into a tangle of extension cords and speaker wire. He shoved the shears and then the leather holster back into the drawer and slammed it shut. He threw himself against the back of his chair and regarded the tiny tree with a hot, "There, are you happy now?" sort of disgust. He cocked his head derisively, concluding that it was absolutely the ugliest, hacked-up, ill-conceived, asymmetrical bonsai he had ever seen. Two-thirds spiraling gracefully outward and upward, while one-third was a barren, unharmonious disgrace to the laws of universal balance. A thumping sound filtered down through the ceiling. Then a laugh. Susan's laugh. She was teasing Ben in that sing-song voice of hers. Ben jumped again and rattled the miniature bamboo chimes on the shelf above the stereo. K-I-S-S-I-N-G, they shouted in unison. K-I-S-S-I-N-G. The toilet tank of rage filling his subconscious now spilled over. He knew it was not a taunt. He knew they were still carrying on about Ben's secret love for Mei Chang, but it felt like a taunt. Inside, where he was gasping for breath beneath oceans of anger, he heard it as a taunt. In his heart, now molten, it was Susan yelling down at him through the floorboards, yelling down at him through all the years of their marriage. In his heart, he knew that she had allowed him to misjudge her, allowed him to underestimate her. And that she had been observing him, judging him from the beginning. She had secretly preserved enough of her old, reckless, foolish, self-involved, oh, look at me, I am oh so independent spirit, that at the drop of a hat, and at her age, she still thinks she's a free agent. Damn her responsibilities, damn his feelings, she'll just drop everything and zip up to Peebles for a week to save the world and fuck other women. At her age.
and her parting shot out the door is to judge him as less of a man for his marital fidelity. To judge him as beneath the interest of a woman in her sexual prime like Beth. To judge him as a gutless, sanctimonious braggart who doesn't have the balls to seize a sexual opportunity, even in the extraordinary, totally unimaginable, completely hypothetical event of such an opportunity ever, ever, ever being offered to him. Who does she think she's talking to? Sure, the starburst swim trunks were gone now, but the man was still very much intact. So she could seize the moment, and he could not. Was that it? Was that the game? Well, screw that. Hollis knocked the amputated bonsai with the back of his hand harder than he intended in the decisiveness of the moment. The little tree in its pot upended and disappeared over the back of the desk, clunking horribly down the wall, scattering a spray of dirt and moss. He stood abruptly, willing to claim and accept this arboreal violence as something already done, whether or not fully intended, and stormed out of the study. He took the stairs in long, gulping strides, two at a time, grabbed his wallet, keys, and jacket in one fluid motion, and slipped into the garage without a word or so much as a click of a latch. Within minutes, jaws clenched and his blood pounding out Wagnerian cadences in his ears, he was threading the late-morning traffic up the I-70. By the time he reached the Westin some 20 minutes later, he had coaxed his relaxed, "all the world is as it should be" smile back onto his face. As he stepped out of the car, he unzipped his jacket in spite of the rain, which had grown heavy since the drizzle of his meditation, and tucked his shirt into his trousers as snugly as he could. He was, by God, vital. He looked carefully around the lobby as he made for the elevator bay from which she had first emerged the previous night, dipped in tawny yellow. He half expected to see her lounging about reading the paper or returning from the dining room. Driving back from the party, they had agreed to meet late in the afternoon. There had been talk of a tour of the OFSC offices and an impromptu visit with Simon Neal, who was likely handling all internship matters while Vernon Ashe was down with the flu. Until then, she would lounge around, she said. She would read her book. Not seeing her, Hollis slipped into the elevator just as the door was opening. "Beth, I want you to know that your offer last night was beautiful." "No." "Beth, I want you to sit down for a moment. I've got to tell you..." "No." "Beth, I want you to know that your offer last night was beautiful and special to me. I know I'd had a few last night, and I know you did too, and, well, I just didn't want alcohol to be a part of it. I wanted to have a clear mind. Beth, I'm here because it's a glorious morning and because my mind is clear and at peace, and I want to share last night's moment this morning. Right now, Beth. I want you right now." Or something like that. The elevator door opened onto the 7th floor. He walked with a seemingly casual composure to the end of the hall, following the carpet pattern of leaves and tangled vines that he had traced barely 8 hours earlier. He felt a fluttering in his chest that spread to a slight tremor in his pocketed hands. At her door, he drew in a breath and straightened himself again, marveling that what he had taken with such detachment last night, albeit stunned detachment, was now the source of such nervousness. He knocked. He could hear her moving about inside, a bathroom cabinet closing, a shower curtain moving on its metal rod. A toilet flushed, and for an instant he thought of the bonsai on his desk and its severed limb on the floor by the baseboard heater. The door opened. A young, petite Japanese woman stood in the doorframe. She was everything he had initially expected Suki Takata to look like. Hollis blinked at her and then at the number on the door. 713. Right room. Wrong person.
Sorry,
he stammered. "You looking?" she said, nodding her head sweetly. "I'm looking for..."
"No here."
The woman smiled, shrugging at him. He saw now that she wore a uniform. Behind her,
Back by the bed in which he had never lain was a white housekeeping cart.
Check out. No here, see? No here.